in to make sure that everything is good with our live feeds and stuff. So thank you all for coming out, and we'll be ready to go in just a minute or two. Thank you.
We're good.
Okay. All right, guys. Thank you so much for coming out. It's my pleasure here to be here for Backstory Events and Guitar World at Cutting Room in beautiful New York City. And today we're going to have, as you know, a great interview, and then from the forward of the Magpie Salute. And we got some shows coming up tomorrow night in Fairfield, Connecticut, and then Wednesday and Thursday at Irving Plaza in New York, one of my favorite venues, and I'm sure a lot of you guys here are going to be there, and everyone listening out there also. I just checked, and there's a handful of tickets available, so I would grab them because I'm sure they won't be there the night of the show. I hope you all can come. Magpie Salute have their first album out. We'll be talking about that and about the show. So let's bring Rich and Mark up and give them a big welcome. Thank you. Congratulations on everything that's happened in the last year or so. So, a year ago, I think, you didn't have Magpie Salute didn't exist. Now you've got all these shows under your belt. You got an album out. The band actually came about quite organically, right? Can you tell us a little bit about...
Sure. I was touring on my solo record last year in 2016, and this opportunity came up to do these shows in Woodstock, and it was something I had done before, and I remember thinking it was a cool thing to do, you know? But I wanted to do something different, and the older I get, the more that I realize what a gift it is to play with people that you have this musical connection with, and, you know, to be excited about what someone is bringing to the table. So with Mark, I mean, I remember bringing songs to the Crows and just being like, I can't wait to hear what Mark plays on this, or the same thing with Ed. I mean, you know, just sitting in a room and having these songs, and just, and Mark's first thing was amazing, Ed's first thing was amazing, you know, to me, and I was like, you know, it was great. And so having that connection, and then also thinking about just the spending a lot of time on a bus with someone is a pretty intimate experience. You know, you see people at their best and their worst. You see them first thing in the morning. You see them, you're the last to see them when they go to bed. So it's kind of interesting.
Good night, dear.
Yeah. And it's, but to me, it's profound in a sense because you have, and it was odd. To have that existence with Mark and Ed and just have them go.
Right.
Did you know what I mean? Like, just then they're just not there. And that's an odd feeling, you know, because you do spend such a concentrated time. And all of those reasons are just like, I'm going to call Mark and do something cool and different and bring. And then I called Mark and he was into it. And I called Ed. And Ed's like, hello. And I'm like, hey, man. Stock and play. Mark's coming.
All right, man, I'll be excited.
So it was cool, and it proved me right.
Mark, what was your reaction when Rich called you?
Yes.
You know,
it didn't really matter what. It was just play music again. Just to say, how are you doing?
Had you guys been in touch? I mean, you haven't played together in about 10 years.
We were on like, when we had the flood, I mean, Mark's guitars were up way up high, so they weren't destroyed. Well, some of them weren't destroyed. And so when all the gear came out to L.A., Mark and I had a mutual friend. I'm like, man, just tell Mark his guitars are here, and you can bring them to him. Go ahead. And so, you know.
Yeah, I heard about your dad.
Yeah, and you reached out about that as well.
Yeah, I mean, everyone might not know that story. So your guitars were in storage here in New York, right?
Jersey, yeah.
And they got flooded in Sandy, right?
Yeah, exactly.
How much did you end up losing? You personally, it was not just yours, it was the Black Crowes.
90% of the Crowes gear was mine. It's just the way it is. I collected a lot of guitars over the years, and then tons of amps and horseshit. But I was 70 guitars and tons of amps, right? I mean,
lots.
How many dumpsters of stuff did you throw away?
Three.
360 yard dumpsters worth of shit. And then we just tossed it because it was beyond repair. Doug had sent me pictures of himself in a hazmat suit because it was filled with mold. You know, there was like, what, 2 or 3 weeks where you couldn't get in. There was too much debris. And then finally, when it opened, everyone that was allowed in there had to wear hazmat suits to keep the mold off, you know. And so I saved 4 guitars, really.
And then we went on tour.
Or did you save 4 because those were the 4 savable, or were there 4 that you said that we must save these 4?
There was 4 that I said that, you know, I really wanted to save. My Gold Top and my 335. And, you know, and luckily for me, there's this company somewhere down in South Lexington, Kentucky, that restored a bunch of stuff from the Nashville flood. And they were able to save those 2 guitars. And then I sent one of my guitars to the manufacturer, and they put a new back on it and stuff like that. But it was, one guitar turned out better, and the rest of them are kind of shit.
We did an interview for Guitola not too long after that, and you had a pretty good attitude about it. I mean, part of you was sort of like, well, the Black Crowes had a lot of bad juju, and that maybe that washed it away. Right?
It's true. I mean, energy is energy, and not to get too, some people get, you know, cosmic or gnomish. But on the flip side, there is an energy that attaches to certain things, and when something is incredibly unhealthy and can be really dark, you know, either by proxy of what I place on those objects symbolically or legitimately, there's bad energy attached to that shit. And water in certain cultures does clear that. Water takes that energy away. And so in a sense, at first, I didn't even think about it. I was, you know, oh shit, that sucks, you know. I was actually in Atlanta, and I was like, oh, well, you know, those poor people, just going on with my life, like, holy shit, my stuff's up there. And because there, I saw footage, and they were like, there's, you know, 10 feet of water in, you know, Weehawken, which is exactly where our stuff was. And I called Doug, and Doug was like, yeah. He said there was 7 feet of water that filled the space. And when he would open my guitar vaults, water poured out of all the guitars, and some of them just had it. And they were just soaking in there for, you know, several weeks.
I feel like we have to be quiet now.
But to me, you know, it's just shit. It's just wood with some strings on it, and I can get some other wood with some strings on it, and it'll sound the same because it comes from me or Mark or whoever it is.
Mark, when we did an interview over the summer, you were obviously really excited about Magpie Salute.
Yeah.
You also said in your mind the band was only 13 days old, because at that point you had 13 gigs, I think. Well, so you've got a lot more under your belt now. So you both were telling me how excited you were to see how it grew. So
yeah.
How's it grown?
Oh, we're sick of each other. It's fucking done, man. We dare each other to do it, and it's over. I mean, literally in the last couple of days, the growth each day, it's not bullshit. I'm astounded over and over and over again. Because it's like, after all the work we've done, you know, 60 shows or whatever, and living together in extreme circumstances, the personality of this group of people is coming out. The music, personality of music is coming out. So it's like, it's flipped now. You know, it's not remnants of what used to be. It's this brand new band playing some older songs, getting ready to move on to this. It's like, this is just the stuff. Usually people do this in garages or in rehearsal rooms, and we just did it in front of everybody.
So we were doing an interview on Sirius earlier today, and the guy asked me what similarities there were. And, you know, Shake Your Moneymaker, I was 15 when I started playing guitar, really, you know, and started writing for Shake Your Moneymaker when I was 17. But it's all emulation. You're emulating your... Because I was living at home. I didn't have any life experience, you know. So I remember thinking, I want to write a song like that. I want to write, you know, it's the last song on Beggar's Banquet, you know, Salt of the Earth. And I'm like, that's the kind of song I want to write, you know. So that's... And Chris wanted to be Rod Stewart, period. That was it. No bones about it. And but, you know, through that, we made this great record. I'm incredibly proud of it. It set us up for a life, you know. And but it wasn't until Southern Harmony that we became who we were. And that was our first stamp as to, like, we stepped into ourselves. And this is what we're going to be. And it's not about all that other shit. It's not about the Stones or the Faces. This is about us. And in the same sense, because this came across or came about so organically, what I liked about it was that it was just kind of grew. It's just this little thing that grew. It's like, yeah, let's get together and play for a weekend. That'll be fun. We go and do it. And we felt like there was something special. We felt like there was something there. And we felt like, oh, wow, let's try this. Let's dip our toe in the water. And then, you know, the Gramercy came, and then it was like, well, shit, let's keep doing this and grow. Oh, we have a record, and this, we have a new song, and this. And then we went on tour, you know. And poor John, man, I mean, he had the biggest shoes to fill, because he's, in my opinion, an incredibly talented singer. He loves me, he and I are really good friends. He loves the Black Crowes. He loves Chris. He wants to show his honor and respect for the work we did. And he's gonna do that, but he's also bringing himself to it. And like Mark was saying, most frontmen do that when they're 20, playing to two people in a club. You kind of get all the kinks out. But now he's kind of thrust into this zone where people are constantly drawing comparisons. And he's handled it brilliantly because he's a gentleman, and he really does respect and love this. And you can see it all over. And that kind of works with all of us. And this year was about us living, kind of really being born, living off of something, the music that we all had reverence for, be it Crowes music, be it cover tunes, Mark and I songs, whatever. But come February when we go into the studio, that's where we become ourselves and start.
But the songwriting that you're doing, the recording you're doing, I guess is going to be a lot different than if you had decided to do that a year ago, because you do have all these shows under your...
Yeah, but, you know, look, I mean, everyone is a professional. I mean, everyone. And the funny thing is that everyone has played in a context together, in different contexts. So, to me, what was cool is me and Joe have had our thing for years, Joe Magistro, and he's my favorite drummer of all time to play with. And then Sven came in, and I've always loved Sven. Sven, to me, is like me and Mark in the sense that when a bass player comes and lays it down, Sven will instantly choose the right shit to play all the time, period. You know, so on some of the other records, I had to play bass because what wasn't really happening. But when Sven came on board, it's like, I don't have to do that. You know? And so there's that contingent, and then there's Mark, and then John's coming in new, and John and I were in Hookah Brown, and I respect his talent. So it's cool to fit this puzzle together and just to see how it's going to all work. But everyone's at that level where they're going to bring the necessary amount. And then we brought in Nico, and so Nico's positive energy, and Nico kind of brought this youthful exuberance and can-do attitude, where he remembers all the parts that we threw out. So, can still see and hear.
Well, you know, you just play the parts. You created them, and he studied them.
Exactly.
So it's different.
Exactly.
Well, also, and this has really shown to me recently, as we learn how to make 3D, it allows our thing to expand into a new thing, another element, and we're figuring out how all that works, and it's getting to be so strange that then we just send one big guitar, and then we'll instantly be 3 separate different instruments, you know, it's getting to be laser surgery after slugging it out a little bit.
Hey, Rich, you were talking about how, you know, it felt like Southern Harmony is where the Black Crowes became a more original entity, which is also when Lamar came around. So, what did he bring to the... Well, first of all, where did you find him? And what did he bring, like, musically? Was it part of that development you were talking about, or how much of it was because you had this new blood and new...
I was just sleeping on the street in the Sunset Strip. Chris kicked him and said, "Hey, you want to join this band?" Chris met you through Broken Homes, right? There was some sort of Broken Homes connection.
Well, I remember a writer at Annie suggesting to me that I should check out you guys, which he just done with Chris, and that we were on similar things, and we should find each other. And then I was given this promotional copy of the record before it came out. And I hadn't bought a ghetto blaster with my Epic record, you know, advance money back.
It was a very intriguing.
From my 66 Dodge Dart with my pregnant wife in front. I go to drive home and put it in, and I get the second song starts, and I pull the car over, and I just said, "Oh my God, listen, that guy sing. He sings like I play guitar. Like, well, we're going to play together." And we just drove home and listened to the record. And the next thing I know, they're coming to town and looked out.
How much did you guys then and now work out guitar parts versus just start playing and play off the joint?
Zero. Absolutely zero.
We faked our way into this. I mean, really. I didn't take lessons to do any of this. You just make your way. Like you say, you copy until you understand it.
I mean, the parts for the songs were the parts. So the songs had their thing, and Mark just came in and brought everything he brought, you know, which for the first time, and I remember seeing an old video of this interview I did right after Mark told me, and it wasn't necessarily a nice comment about Jeff Sees, but I said, you know, for the first time, kind of Mark, what he brought to the table warranted 2 guitar parts. You know, Shake Your Moneymaker was almost like AC/DC. It was just, you know, strumming the chords and just doing this thing for Jeff. I mean, he just basically doubled what I was doing. But when we got to that, I mean, that was 22 months and 350 shows on tour, and we learned how to be a band. And we really learned how to be a band on Heart, because Heart's crowd hated us. And so we just kind of turned our backs and just played to each other for the first time and really learned how to play on that. And then you could just see how it kept growing. And the songs kept growing. We could have put at least 1, if not 2 records out before Southern Harmony of stuff, because Chris and I just kept writing, and, you know. But we were still on tour, so it was like, and then by the time we got to make, you know, the record, Chris and I went in his garage in Atlanta, just wrote it over 3 days. It was a weekend, and George was up talking on the phone the whole time. He was never downstairs, and he opened the door. We're like, "Finished?" You know, so we want to get started. We're like, "Man, we're done." And then we went in the studio, made it in 8 days, just live. You know, everything was 1 or 2 takes done, just getting it out. And Mark came in, just pretty much every solo was, you know, all the parts were just played. I mean, every solo was 1 take, except for sometimes audition.
It was just an explosion, and I had been on tour myself and playing, so we met each other ready to play. You know, they had been on the road, I'd been on the road, and it was just time, and like, it was the same thing when I saw Woodstock when I came, since playing, like, blow it or whatever happened, trying to get there, I got there and I said hi. And they went on and I watched or something. After realizing, wow, this is really good. And then watching, and I'm like, Rich needs a void. Like, I saw you go through almost all of your stuff and then start to go through your stuff, and I go, he needs someone. That's what's missing. That's the one, you know. And that then it dawned on me exactly, like, the thing and how it works. It's a pushing around, it's also a loop, you know. It's a language. It's really cool.
I mean, it's funny because John talks about it as well, listening to Steve. There's a whole, the way Chris sings with Steve and the way Steve and I would play, and then the way Mark and I would play, it's always this kind of amoeba, like pushing and pulling the whole time. But it lends itself to something pretty interesting. So, but that's the thing. I mean, right now it just seems effortless with the two of us playing, because it's just, we're just always there together. And even from our solo stuff, I mean, Mark's got songs that are the same title as my song. You know what I mean? Like, the growth of show. You know, it's like, yeah, there's a lot of interesting correlations that we have in common.
So you mentioned you're going into the studio in February.
Yes.
So is the songwriting, are you doing collaborative songwriting, or are you each bringing in separate songs? Or you...
No, we're trying to do collaborative songwriting, really, with me, Mark, and John. If 10 people wrote, I mean, it would be a nightmare. Just logistically, like, shit, we could be looking at 100 songs. So, you know, Mark and I and John are really starting. I sent them about 35 things, and I just started writing at sound checks, and we had about 5 new things. Mark sent me some cool stuff. So it's good for the two of us that are so focused on finishing our shit to not finish your stuff, you know what I mean? Just to kind of hold yourself back and be like, okay, you know? Which is good. It's a good exercise.
And I should say, this is singer, it's John Hogg.
John Hogg.
Anyone doesn't know. But the way you were describing writing Southern Harmony with Chris, so was your guys' songwriting live together, the two of you in a room making these songs?
Sometimes, you know, early on it was that way. You know, Chris's enthusiasm was a strong catalyst. He did bring a lot of enthusiasm. And Mark does it now too. He'll hear, I'll play some, you know, stuff, and it's almost like I'm circling around. I'll have a part, and then I'll add this part, and then I'll add that part, and then put them all together. And so Chris would be like, "Oh man, that's great. Let's, you know, what about that?" And I'll do this, and I'll write a chorus. That needs a bridge. I'll write a bridge. And so it was collaborative back then, and it was much cooler and far more positive back then. As time went on, it got more aggressive, so to speak.
You know, territorial,
yeah, just more like, you know. But it was, you know, it flowed. It was one of those things that just kind of flowed.
It just brothers.
Yeah, it just brothers.
Well, Mark, we hear about the brother stuff a lot. What's it like to be a bandmate in a band where the core members are shooting brothers? Was that difficult for you and other people to navigate?
Well, early on, we were all confused and young and trying to figure stuff out in this situation. The thing that I found was the coolest at the core of this thing, they were separate, so everyone had to choose a side. That good crows and the bad crows, so it's, you know, what it ended up being, which is...
I was the good crow. It was everyone else.
Generally, they're all married. You did. If they were feuding, you had to be on one or the other side. You know? And it did allow us to get to know each other.
I mean, obviously you got to know each other musically, but you're talking about as people, as friends.
Yeah, now we get to, you know, I like this guy. I
connected. I didn't know.
Well, since you didn't really know each other, what if you had gotten there and found out you didn't like them? Yeah. I mean, wasn't there a risk in that when you guys, when you...
But we already did. Yeah. That works, too, but it's not worth getting through.
How quickly did you realize once Ed and Mark came to Woodstock, at what point did it occur to you, this isn't just a fun weekend jam session, this can be a band? And then the next part is, but we need one more guy.
You know, the groundwork was already there, because I know what Mark's capable of, and I know what he would bring. And, you know, like he said, he was supposed to come in the night before. We were supposed to have a rehearsal. His flight was canceled, and he had to spend the night in Chicago. And so we've started. I mean, he came in halfway through our first set. It was like, you know, we didn't really have time to go over any songs. But then he sat down, and within, you know, it was just like that. It was the one, it didn't leave. It never left. It's that connection that kind of spans space and time.
Yeah, I realized that, you know, for a while, just personally, I was trying to get as far away from any of this as I could, and just what else is there, you know? And then now I'm getting to sort of come back again and realize that it was like it never ended in a way. It's just very much similar. Exactly the same, will always be. That's the good stuff. And the stuff that didn't work is gone. And I just realized, like, this is a huge part of my life, whether I want it to be or not. I have to accept this as family. This really is my family more than anything else. You know, the history, I have a 30-year Woodstock history. So, there's a lot in there, you know. And even though if you counted days together, they may not seem like much, but they're both in days.
And of course, Ed was part of that. Ed Harsh, who was with you in Woodstock, as you mentioned, and then was supposed to be in this band, and, you know, died before you played the shows at Gramercy with Theater here in New York, which were really your first shows outside of there. So I guess it's one of those things, as tragic as it is, it's also beautiful that you did have that reunion. I don't know.
I would call Ed twice a year. Since he left, you know, just to check up on him, because I always loved Ed, and, you know, there's a record he and I played on in Canada, this Trues record, you know, we both were there at the session, and so I would always call him, because he's, at his core, he's a great person and has a great heart, you know, he was a good, kind person, but also a brilliant musician, and so I would always check in, but there's about 5 times where I'd be like, all right, I'm making a record, you coming down? All right, man, I'll come down. And then, like, he would blow off the flight. I can't get my, you know, it's like there was always something, and he would frustrate me so bad.
Ed, get it together.
But when this happened, and I called him, and I said, look, Mark's coming, so you're coming down. He goes, I'll be there, man. And I was like, all right, he had to get a passport because he was in Canada. And I'm like, can you be sure you can figure that one out? And so we almost had a running bet, like, oh, shit. And I didn't want to tell Mark until I got a 70% chance this guy's coming. You know? But he came, and, you know, he hadn't been playing a lot. You know, but he quickly settled in and played some brilliant shit, and just now listening back to the record, it's just like, shit,
it's inspired.
I mean, it's so, like, it's one of those things, and it's always a shame that we wait till someone dies before we truly appreciate what they bring, you know. And I always appreciated it, and I always knew he was brilliant, but then it's just like maybe you listen with bigger ears, or you microscopically focus on what's happening. But what Ed brought to the table is fucking stunning.
Well, and playing these songs for him would be absolutely amazing. Made me understand, like, he could have wide slide. He was written into this music.
Well, he wrote himself into it.
You know, when you hear this music without him.
And when you were playing...
The funny thing is, when you look back at videos, and he's over there. listened back.
Jesus, man. How's he doing?
And it was brilliant. I mean, it was absolutely brilliant.
And when you played those shows, I mean, obviously none of you knew at that moment you were making a record, that anybody outside of that room would ever hear it. So there's something sort of poetic that you did end up ultimately putting out his final performance.
And no one had more fun that weekend than that. Yeah. I mean, he was like in hell.
I had a weekend with him and stayed in the cabin next door and just stayed up laughing at cartoons like we always did. Belly hacking, old men laughing, you know, and boom. And just like again, like no time had passed whatsoever. I never seen that happen, really. It was so incredible. And then you listen to the record and literally it felt like saying hello for the first time. Because I got there like, and it's like you can hear us saying hi.
As you start getting more original music, and after the record comes out, I assume next spring or summer, or whenever that may be, will it really affect the way you're approaching these shows? Like, when you start dropping, you know, you'll have more original music, so you'll be dropping some of the covers, you'll drop some of the pro songs.
I think that the skeleton of the set will be what this band is, which is these new songs. I mean, it's no one's desire to go out there and play Black Crow songs for the rest of our life.
So there's no one's desire to get rid of them.
But it's no one's desire to get rid of them, but because we're always going to celebrate that, you know, because it's a huge portion of my life's work, you know, and so.
Someone said it really good the other day. This is the extension of everything that was. This is the continuation of the story, the cases.
But to have that skeleton of us, because once these songs are made, that will be us.
Right.
And then we can hang all these other ornaments on it.
Right. And I'm sure over the years, when post-Crows and in-between-Crows, you know, hiatuses and whatnot, that when you were playing your solo shows, you felt the reaction when you would play Black Crow's music, I'm sure.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, because everyone coming to see me was a Black Crowes fan first, and that's just the way it is, you know. And I've never made, I wasn't delusional enough to think that wasn't the case, you know what I mean?
And that's a good thing.
That is a good thing. But you know, I'm also making my own records and writing other songs too, and so the cool thing is for people to come and see me in a new or a different context, and to see that things have changed. And so that's a good thing as well.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. And I will say, this is sort of a left turn, but this is we're here in New York and talking about the Black Crowes. The 2001 fall shows at the Beacon were really meaningful for a lot of people. I don't remember exactly how close after 9/11 it was, but it seemed like it was right after. Yeah. And the city. It was so, we everyone here was so broken. Our spirits and souls were really in a bad place. And you gave tremendous uplift at those shows. So thank you for that. Yeah. I know there was talking about
you. We were playing at the Greek that night, September 11th. And when that, we were talking about this the other day, when that happened, we were just like, you know, we canceled the show. And we were going to cancel the tour. And our manager started calling around to promoters, just saying they were like, please don't cancel the shows. And we got 500 calls from just saying they won't do anything but watch the fucking TV. And then when we came to those, I think it was five nights at the Beacon, we donated $150,000 of all, you know, basically all the profit from those shows. But yeah, it was heavy. I mean, shit.
And I'm sure the money did great things, but I think what you provided spiritually was bigger than the money. Because the money could come from somewhere else, but that couldn't.
Exactly. But we wanted big. We have always had a huge love and appreciation for New York in particular, and wanted to do everything. You know, so Chris and I think it was 2001, but we had to fill in at Conan. Conan called us because we were playing Conan O'Brien, because we were playing at the Beacon. He's like, look, I lost my guests, they're not flying, you guys come down and do something. Chris and I went down there, I played my song, and it was heavy, some heavy shit, you know, pretty crazy.
I was looking through a photo book by Kirk West, and he had this photo from, I don't know what year it was, 93 or 94, of you guys playing with the Allman Brothers in a studio in
Florida.
Miami.
That was 95. And it was, we were playing with Dead, so we were playing with, at Tampa Stadium, and it was our first show with the Dead, and last show. And for some reason, at the same time, we were like, I don't know how that happened.
We went to Doug's house for barbecue.
Yeah, but then it was a day off. It was the night before that show, and we were in the studio with the Allman Brothers, and you guys stayed. I left. Chris and I got in a fight. And then Greg yelled at Chris. Greg was like,
he was hammered.
Chris was running his mouth, and Greg's like, you shut the hell up. You still have a brother. That's what he said. Greg's words, not mine. And Greg had this morning. Chris felt really guilty. He got up and apologized to me the next day. Probably the only time he ever apologized.
Did anything ever come out of that? Like, was there ever an intent to record things, or was it just a fun generation?
You know, I remembered it. We were at Doug's house and then just went over to the studio.
Doug Dunn was our sound guy's father.
Oh, wow.
So when we would go down to Florida, we would go over to Doug's house, and so it was, kind of became this thing where every time we would go down there, old Doug would invite us over, and we would.
And I don't know how we got it. They were rehearsing in their studio. That's the story. And Greg was drinking at the time. Pissed everybody off. Now they all left them. We were just going to go say hi to them, see them rehearse, but they all left, and he was. And it just turned in. And so Warren was there, Woody, and Mark was there. And then we ended up jamming some, but it gets. Set an alarm went off in there, all of a sudden people went, there's sirens outside, it covers it up. He goes, well, oh no, they're banging on the door, the badges, he's like, well, Greg goes, they got hoses or guns? So the alarm went off, he had smoked quite a bit.
They're great pictures. Have you seen that?
Yeah.
What's been the nicest surprise or just the nicest part of this of your musical reunion?
For me, to see what a dad is.
For me, it's more like, I feel like Mark and I have been on kind of a parallel journey, and to learn a lot from Mark, and actually the two of us watching each other and kind of getting to this point, where you can lose your ego, and you can lose your horseshit that you have when you were young, and as a constant reminder to look over at Mark and be like, oh shit. I need to not be a dick here. You know what I mean? I gotta try to drop the judgment or whatever it may be. All the shit that everyone has to deal with. And it's really helped open my eyes to a whole other scenario in life, which is cool.
I think that's a huge reason for the success that's going on with this music. It's borrowing agreement to make music was like, basically, let's not be dicks so we can have this in our mind. We just do whatever it takes to back and live. I realize it was cooler when we were in Miami.
Right, and you've gone through, obviously, perspective on these things are different at our age than they are when we were 20 or 25.
Drama is boring. And there's a trap that every band falls into, where everyone takes everything fucking personally, and then you go in the back lounge, you start bitching about each other, and then you stay in your bunk, and then you just go. It's just this. It's like being in a band 101. You know, just and that's easy to fall into. Those traps are easy to fall into. And so we have to be vigilant not to do that and realize that someone is having a bad day, maybe it's not about you. Which seems so obvious, but it's just like, shit, man. You know, we all that we're musicians, everyone's weird anyway because we're musicians. But then on top of that, you know, our oversensitivity or whatever we have to deal with, we don't even realize how. I look at musicians as almost every one of us has Asperger's. It's just like, because we don't pick up on social cues when we're in these funks. We'll just like talk in the morning, just like
the irony. This last night, that like each one of us are the misfits that didn't really want to hang out.
Yeah.
Then end up going, okay, now live together and see what happens.
Yeah. And people like John and Nico really help. Not that Nico's here. I'm not just saying it because Nico's over there and he's bigger than all of us, so beat us up. But it's more about the reality of it. It's just like seeing things through their eyes, like seeing this. You know, Nico's an incredibly gracious person and grateful, and he shows gratitude every day. John is the purest, nicest, kindest human I've ever met, and he has gratitude every day. You know, sometimes I'll wake up and be like, like, oh shit, what's going on today? And John just comes in with this smile, like he goes over there like, hey, this is great. You know, but that's important. Someone's got to do that. Because if not, then there's just a bunch of old assholes sitting around.
Yeah, I mean, the longest shittier day is in any of the days. You know what I mean? Like, it doesn't do bad. It's a dead day.
Yeah.
It's all up. So nice to get focused.
And is that, I mean, has it been hard for you over the years? Did you ever regret leaving the Black Crowes, or was it just what you had to do at the time?
No, it was just what, you know, I was, I what I was looking for wasn't there, and I, you know, I was caught up in a mortgage, and the family wasn't together, and I was alcoholic, and it was, you know, it was what I worked my entire life for to get there. I didn't solve anything. You know what? You know, I was just delusional and didn't have the balls to quit. Dumps with
all the
better handler just said, I can't do this right now. You know, I'm not. But to get to like see these people mad tonight just lit up. You know,
right, the time on stage just changes all the time off stage you forget about, right?
This was, I mean, back in Black was where I couldn't get away from high school. And I think, like, Sudden was somebody who's back in Black.
Right, right.
In a sense, you know what I mean? A backdrop to their life, it's pretty powerful.
Right, you mentioned that before too, Richard, but you grew up with these, you know, maybe not Back in Black, but, you know, whatever, Dylan and Stone's records, that meant so much to you.
I just know in high school.
Yeah, I understand.
There is.
Yeah,
right.
No, but I mean, it doesn't matter. But it's the same concept. What I mean, whatever that incredible record is, it was a soundtrack to your life. You've provided that for a lot of people as well.
I mean, that's... I mean... A lot of times, I'm oblivious sometimes. I'll meet people and they'll come around and they'll kind of like look at me weird. I'm like, hey, just like, you know, like, I'm like, why is this dude looking at me weird, you know? And then I'm unaware of it, but the guy will say, you know, Southern Harmony, you know, changed my life, and then I'm like, oh shit, you know? And it's incredibly humbling to have my music do that to someone. I mean, when I first heard Dylan, or when I first got Neil Young, when I first heard like Torn and Frayed, and it just fucking hit me like a diamond bullet, to quote Marlon Brando. But that stuff just shakes you to your core, and it can be like your, it can be your lifeblood. It can save you. And that's the thing about like Black Crowes fans and now Magpie fans. And, but the amazing thing is to see how, like I said this the other day, we were playing a club in Florida, and there wasn't a huge amount of people there, and someone was out there just dancing, just by themselves, just like rocking the hell out. And I was like, it filled me with so much joy, and it impressed me at the bravery that still in this day, with a fucking Netflix and your phone and your bullshit and everyone has to deal with, that someone can allow themselves to be taken to a place in an authentic scenario, and then without a care about what anyone else around them is doing or how they look to someone. They just let that happen to them. They ride that wave.
That's what you're doing.
Yeah. Well, hey, they're doing it. They're the one that's tapped in, you know? And there's nothing on earth better than that, to watch people lose themselves in this medium, in this forum. Right. You know?
And I had a conversation recently with O'Keele, said very much the same thing, that that was his most favorite thing in the world on stage, was just to see somebody doing that.
Yeah.
I think we're
in, man. I mean, it really is, because people just let it out. It's cathartic, and it's amazing.
We're getting close to the end here. We're going to take some questions from the crowd. I think, is it that time now, Brett? Yeah, so if anyone has questions, good questions, I hope, raise your hand.
No shit questions.
Brad's got the microphone.
Do you have a shit question, Les?
It's open.
All right. Ellen. My question is on the news today. You would know the news today.
The news today?
As the crow flies.
Oh, yeah. How do you know about that?
What?
They released
the Invasion One.
Oh, okay.
They're doing a lot. There's a lot of rumors.
Yeah. Oh, okay, cool.
Are you threatened by it? Are you insulted by it? Are you glad you got in first? And will you play Lincoln? Because you know, this is what I'm traveling the world for, and God made me go see.
What was that question?
You know, it's a complicated situation.
Yeah.
It's really only, if Chris had just kept his mouth shut all year, and just decided to play songs that he and I wrote, I mean, that's his prerogative, and that's cool, and he'll bring himself to those songs. The fact that he ran his mouth all year about how stupid this is and how we're just a cover band, and then to turn 180 degrees and just be a cover band with the B-Squad, it's kind of like, you know, it's very hypocritical. But he has every right to do that, and if for whatever reason he needs money or whatever, I mean, or whatever reason that he's doing that, he has every right, and I wish him well. You know, we're more excited about going into the studio and seeing what we can do as a band, you know. And, you know, that's what I'm supposed to be. You know, ultimately, at the end of the day, although there's a glaring hypocrisy to the whole thing, he can do that, and I wish him well. You know, I've got Mark Ford.
So, you're doing the album in February. When will you guys do the tour for that? Can't wait to see some more shows. Just loving this. Please don't stop.
It'll take a month or two to make the record, because it's a double album, so it's going to be long. So, we'll be out next summer.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Okay, one more here.
come to Australia.
And how is that your house?
I will do that. You've got to play Lincoln.
Oh, okay. You're the one.
Thanks for your inspiration. I guess it wouldn't be a question without technicality since we're here for the guitar world. Some of us like to emulate you behind closed bedroom doors. Maybe you could recommend something, equipment, guitar brand that maybe isn't as higher end. Maybe that's more attainable. Thank you.
I don't know. I mean, you know.
What was the question?
It's just like what, are there any suggestions of like stuff that's more attainable to people instead of, you know, stuff that we play that costs a lot of money, I guess. It really just comes from you, you know, the sound comes from you, the how you choose to do it. There's no way that anyone's ever going to sound like me. I could never sound like Jimmy Page when I was playing his parts, you know. It was funny because I played with Bad Company last year. I just filled in and it was like, you know, I was hoping for some free that, you know, didn't really pan out. But I did play some Bad Company stuff. And it was cool, but, you know, that, I don't sound like that. And so, you know, I mean, there's certain people.
You sound like that if you played his rig.
Yeah, even if I played his rig. So it really doesn't matter, like, how much you spend on stuff. It really just comes from you. You know, Jimmy would pick up my guitar and sound like Jimmy Page. I'd pick up his guitar and I'd sound like me. That's just how it's going to be, you know. So, I mean, there's cool shit out there to buy. So, you know, if it looks good and you think it sounds good, just check it out. You know?
Thank you very much. Thank you, Rick.
Thank you all. Thank you all. Thank you all.
El Caliente.
Thank you.
So this is a Faces song that we do.
Thank you kindly for thinking of me. If I'm not smiling, I'm just thinking. Another song.
Magpies Salute. We just Wednesday and Thursday. At every o'clock, I'm eating lunch right now. Thank you all for coming out for the cutting wheel, for the program, for the backstory event. And there is another show that was supposed to be like 15 minutes ago. So they're going to be moving out, so if you can start getting your stuff together and move, that'd be great. Thank you so much for coming out.